This week on Writers, Inc.
I've used dictation in the past, you know, as like an add-on and when I'm, you know, walking back and forth to work and when I'm in the car, that kind of thing. But I said, you know what? It's so I seem to write so many more words. Like I could sit there for an hour and maybe write 600 or 700 words in front of the computer, but I can dictate that in like 15 minutes.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tumlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. First off, thank you guys for covering for me last week during Project Treehouse.
No worries.
I appreciate it.
How'd that turn out?
Yes. Yeah. It's almost done. So I built a platform. I'm calling it a treehouse, but like I'm kind of faking it. So I built a platform that's 10x8 that's like surrounding trees. So the thing isn't actually built in the tree, but it looks like it's built in the tree. Only because I don't want to have to depend on a tree to hold my daughter, you know, 8 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
but I built the platform. I got the house all framed out. And then I realized that getting up on a ladder to try inside a treehouse, you know, 10 feet off the ground is not something I want to risk right now. So I bought a scaffold, which was actually just delivered about an hour ago. I can finish it up. And they just dropped off a slide too. It's funny, like I told Estes, we have this company called Estes that delivers all the big stuff around here. I don't know if they're national or not. But like they called me yesterday to arrange the delivery window. And I told them, okay, anytime Thursday or Friday, except for Thursday between 12 and 2, I'm out of pocket because of this podcast. And the guy calls me like literally 11:55. He's like, I'm going to be there in about 30 minutes. And I talked him into just leaving it in my driveway, but I watched, like I was listening to the interview, you know, like prepping for the show and stuff like that. And I was watching him through the window as he unloaded this thing. It weighs 110 pounds and it's 14 feet long.
Wow.
Because it's a big, you know, it's like a playground slide. It's not like, you know, the little rinky dink ones. This guy just threw it up on his shoulder and just carried it up my driveway. So kudos to the driver. But that as soon as we hang up on the podcast, I'm going to head out there and try and get the slide installed before my daughter gets home. And then I'll probably side the treehouse this weekend. Then electrical will go in. I'm putting internet out there.
Oh, you weren't kidding about the internet. So
I thought. No, I mean, I've got selfish reasons for it because like. Where the treehouse is, like we own this little forest behind our house, and our Wi-Fi doesn't extend back there. So if I run a Cat 5 cable out to the treehouse, I can put a repeater in the treehouse, and then I can kind of coat our woods with a Wi-Fi signal. So I selfishly want, you know, that's the reason I want to do it. My wife is eyeing the treehouse because she's like, I think I'm going to work out here. So one way or the other, I got to get internet and electric in that thing.
I like it. That's awesome.
It's a long way from when I was a kid. And you know, they handed me like a bunch of, you know, 2x4s with rusty nails in them or whatever. So here you go. Go build your own treehouse.
Well, my dad built us. It wasn't a treehouse because we didn't have a tree. But essentially, if you imagined a tree in there, but it was kind of the same thing. It was like, you know, a raised platform. And it was like it had, you know, like rungs on it and a trapeze bar, a slide, like. They didn't have rock walls back then, but I it wasn't quite a net, but it was like, you know, a diagonal thing that you could climb up.
I had a tree and I just used to climb it with my hands and hide in it and jump down it and scare people. It was the best.
The only feature my treehouse had was tetanus.
You had a house. I just had a tree. Yeah. Just right up the tree. So
and together. We could have had a tree house.
Oh.
Takes a village. A tree village. All right. We better read news, huh?
Yeah. What is in the news?
Better get to it. Can't wait for this one. I know that Christine picked this one just for me.
I did.
You met grandma at a keg party? The rich order $100,000 memoirs for family only. Wealthy retirees are commissioning private family-only memoirs supporting a boutique ghostwriting industry. Most books spotlight humble beginnings and hard work, skimming past divorces or addiction, but some get candid about jail time and drug use, aiming to tell heirs, quote, how we really lived. Banks are in on it. KeyCorp offers 30 to 40 page ghostwritten memoirs to clients with $10 million plus portfolios. Top ghostwriters charge up to $100,000 building page turners from hours of interviews and careful edits. The question is, do families read them? To boost engagement, some opt for $40,000 to $70,000 video documentaries, one even shared via a QR code on a tombstone. You'll have to excuse me. I'm off to go post some ads for a service I'm about to offer.
Wow.
I mean, this is honestly like I made a lot of money writing memoirs for people, and like it's not difficult to do because you sit down, you interview them, you transcribe the interviews, and then you turn it into a book. And it taught me how to write characters because, you know, when you have to write stuff, you know, first person from somebody else's point of view, you know, that teaches you how to write fiction, you know, as well. So like it's a good training ground and it's decent money for people that are trying to break into the industry. So I say go for it.
Yeah. I've never considered a private version of this, but I did this kind of thing in one form and another. I've done this sort of thing throughout my career, especially early on. And you're right. These are easy, especially now. Now it'd be incredibly easy with AI to do, you know, transcription, costing me practically nothing.
They have. I've seen this a couple times, not the boutique memoir with this $70,000 documentary, but they have like where you can like voice record interviews with your family members, and it's an app and it will turn it, like you can upload photos and stuff, and then it will turn it into basically like a book, you know, that features their stories and it'll integrate the pictures. I think that's actually kind of a cool thing. You know, an heirloom of sorts. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, especially if you've had a colorful life, and yeah, I get the desire to pass on your knowledge or your end of life legacy or what have you. So yeah, it's not bad. I don't know that $100,000 would be.
Yeah, I don't know if
an
I
app
love my
sounds
family $100,000 worth. But
yeah,
like,
but these,
you know, a $300 app, maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, but yeah, they're saying this is people who have $10 million portfolios.
Yeah.
So, you know, 100 grand, you know, whatever. Oh, I've got that in my pocket right now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how they do that too, because I used to work in banking and like we weren't allowed to give clients anything, you know, without the regulators jumping down our throats. I'm trying to figure out how they're paying for this and getting away with it, unless it's something specific to banks other than brokerage firms and investment banks. But
that's interesting.
I don't know. I feel like I need to make some
phone
calls.
It might be part of some sort of estate oriented thing. Like, you know, they help with
part
estate
of a
planning
trust
and wills and things like that. So it might fall
yeah,
into some
I mean,
loophole.
If I were going to try to break into this, like that's probably the route I would go. I would probably try to pair up with somebody who does that kind of thing for a living and let them know, hey, I can do this for you. You know, because they've got these people walking through their door on a daily basis, and they can, you know, they can get you in front of the right. Because how else do you market it? You know, like how do you pair up with somebody that wants this on a consistent basis?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, I'll let you know once I figure out how to do this. next up, Focus Friend by Hank Green. Hank Green, in partnership with Honey Bee Games, launched Focus Friend, an ADHD-friendly gamified focus timer for staying off your phone while you write. Set 5 to 120 minutes and a cozy little bean knits while you work. Pick up your phone and you interrupt the knitting, the gentle guilt intended to nudge you back to the page. Each session completes knitting projects that decorate the bean's room. With a pro tier that unlocks fancier projects, the bean stays encouraging even when you slip.
Okay, I love this idea. first, it doesn't just stop the knitting, the stitches slip. So it's far more upsetting. And then you can sell the knitted projects to buy the furniture. But what I really like about this is that it's free. So it doesn't have any, it's free, which a lot of the focus apps out there, you have to pay for in some way to actually get the benefits.
Do people really need this though to sit their butt down in a chair and work?
Yes.
Like, has it come to this?
Yes.
You know, People who have focus issues, like a lot of them do what's called body doubling. So they'll find an accountability buddy to write with. So I think it's kind of the same thing. Some people really do need that
I think for
push to
kids,
sit
it's
down.
becoming more and more and more of a problem. And like, there's a lot of studies that are starting to come out that kids are really struggling who have always lived in this digital era, you know, basically from the time they can basically sit up, they're put in front of an iPad of some sort. And divorcing yourself from that, I think it's hard for us older folk to imagine because, you know, if we were bored on a summer afternoon, we had to go kick rocks until we imagined something to do. We had to entertain ourselves. And now you don't have to do that. And I think it's a big problem. So I actually like that this is very kid friendly, but it's also adult friendly and it's free. So
Well, kids love knitting.
it's adorable. No,
But
the
it's a cute
bean is
little
adorable.
bean
Like
and
the
you can
little
name
room is
it. It's like
adorable.
a, yeah, it's I
What
don't
do they
even know
call
what
that?
cartoon style it is, but it's like a little, it's a
Like a
cartoon. So it's very,
Digipet kind of thing.
yeah, it's like in the
Like
cozy style, like Animal Crossing type things.
I have a controversial hot take that's going to get us email.
Oh
You
God.
ready?
No. Alex, get ready to cut. Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
I don't believe in the existence of ADHD.
Yeah, we're
I
gonna
don't think
cut
it's
that.
real. No, we cannot cut that. But I
We
think
should
it
cut
is
that.
a discipline thing, and I think you're right. You know, we've got people who grew up in an era of, you know, on demand everything all the time, and that's contributed to it. I don't think it's worthy of being called some sort of disorder, but I do think it's a problem. Does that
Well, can you?
salve things?
I
No. Can you
disagree
guys?
1,000% from my professional opinion, so we'll keep that in there too.
Do you guys ever leave the house without your phone?
No,
No.
no,
No.
no.
Where is your phone right now? Is it within arm's reach?
Yep.
I'm current I'm it's
Yep.
currently the camera that I'm staring into.
But you know, I wish JP was here because I just want to plug him. He runs a Twitch stream for co-working, so he just has a camera on while he's working and does like Pomodoros and 45 minutes and then chats for 5 minutes. And those streams are full of people
Let
who
me
just
be
need
clear.
someone to work with,
I
you know?
get that there is a challenge to sitting down and doing, you know, intensive work, deep work for long stretches of time, and that, you know, little tools like this can be handy, I guess. I'm not disparaging the effort to solve this. I just don't think it's a disorder, but
As
that's
someone
awesome.
with ADHD, we will chat after about the struggles I have had with
I
it.
also think that
So,
ADHD aside, we do live in a digital age. And, you know, a lot of people will watch TV in the evenings and they're scrolling their phone.
That's
And,
me.
you know, couples will sit next to each other in the living room, not talking, sending each other reels and memes and videos. And so I think, you know, sort of what this app is trying to do is because it's not necessary, you don't have to use this app for work. So you don't have to use it like a Pomodoro where you're trying to get focused work done. It's literally just to stop picking up your phone and looking at it 10 million times a day. It's just, can you go 30 minutes without looking at your phone and let your little bean knit a scarf? And that's kind of what it's trying to do is disrupt,
Well,
you know, that
what do you
urge.
do with your phone when you're writing? Like I just flip mine over on my
I
desk. I'm
flip
like,
mine
I
over.
don't want to look
I
at it.
hide it
I'll
from
flip it over.
myself.
Mine is sitting on a little display directly in front of me to the right of my keyboard.
Oh, I hide mine. I do think technology exacerbates attention problems
I
for me.
do. Here's my thing though, and call me sort of, I don't know, maybe I'm a something of a sadist, I don't know, but I refuse to let the technology rule me. I know that I have to get this task done, so whether that technology is there to distract me or not, I'm going to get that task done. So that's really what it comes down to for me, and I'm arrogant enough to think that everybody could probably do that, and
No,
I'm not
we
saying
can
it's
talk about
easy.
some struggles with like initiation and how brain function
Oh,
works,
I get it.
you
Believe
know.
me, I do get it. There are days when I fail. So I'm not going to hold it. I'm
Not
not
everyone
criticizing anyone
has
who
the
needs
same
resources.
capabilities, and so
like,
you
you
know,
know,
to start with.
I don't have social media installed on my computer. And so, like, 'cause that's probably the biggest thing. And I've noticed it. Like, I will go to pick up my phone to, check on an Amazon order. Like, did this get delivered? And then if I'm not careful, like suddenly I'm on Instagram sending Christine 13,000 reels. And then I'm like, what am I doing on here? Like, and it can be a
And then
little
I'm the
alarming.
worst. I say, send me 200 more.
Yeah, I know. She encourages it.
I
But
encourage social media behavior.
it can sometimes, especially like if you're tired, if you're stressed. And so I notice those triggers in myself. If I'm tired, if I'm stressed, it gets a lot harder to not just want to like zone out. And so that's why I don't let it have the option, because I can get my texts on my computer and that actually doesn't distract me. I can Google things. The internet doesn't distract me. It's those social media apps that like program that dopamine hit
Oh,
that.
well, I do. I have turned off every single notification from my phone. And then I do go into focus. I turn on the focus mode while I write to make sure no other,
That's all this is. It's just knitting a scarf while you're in focus
Knitting
mode.
a scarf. And if you
Yeah,
pick up your
but I pick up
phone,
the phone
you
frequently.
disappoint your bean. He drops his stitches. You
God,
can't
these
be a
gamification
conscientious.
things never work for me. They just don't. I don't care enough, so it doesn't. It's never going to be helpful to
Needs a
me.
German nanny who just like stands in his doorway very like aggressively and is just like, sit down and write. That's what he needs.
I got that.
All
I
right.
already
We
have
should
that.
move
All
on.
right.
Final story.
Final story. What authors should know about the Anthropic class action suit? The Authors Guild guide says authors do not need to do anything to join the class action suit. If their books were pirated, they are automatically included. However, to receive updates and preserve your chance to opt out, authors should send current contact information and their book titles to the court-appointed class counsel. Counsel will file a list of affected works by September 1st, 2025. Potential payouts, if plaintiffs win, is statutory damages of $750 up to $150 per title.
And I had that link for the appointed class counsel should be in the show notes. So if you want to
Yeah.
opt in.
I'm clicking on it right now because I'm like 150 grand per book. All right, let me fill this guy out. So
Go ahead and submit for me too while you're in there.
I don't even think they have a case, but just in case they do, I will take the, any amount of money, frankly, per book.
Well, if they've already said if they lose this, they're gone. They're no longer solvent. So like I don't know that anybody's even going to collect.
Right, you're right. So, well, whatever. I don't think they have a case.
Not as exciting as knitting beans, to tell you what.
Knitting
No, it's
beans.
not.
That's the title of this episode. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Oh, and with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Jeffrey James Higgins on. This guy he's kind of redefining Write What You Know. He's a retired special agent. He's wrestled suicide bombers, fought the Taliban, chased terrorists across five continents. He channels all of this into his fiction. His latest novel is called The Havana Syndrome, and he's here to tell us all about it. Here he is, Jeffrey James Higgins.
Well, I'm kind of excited about this chat, Jeffrey. I'm talking to Jeffrey James Higgins, who is the author of The Havana Syndrome, which is launching on June 17th. First of a four-book series. Have you got the whole series already written?
I'm working on book four right now. I'm on a 6 month delivery schedule, so they come fast and furious. I think I wrote the Havana Syndrome back in 22. Like a lot of readers never understand that, how long the traditional publishing model is, So yeah, it's been a while.
We should talk about that because a lot of the authors who listen to the show are from the self-publishing world. They don't necessarily understand the sort of life cycle of books from the traditional side of things. So you wrote the book, you wrote the draft in 2022. Was it already something that was, 'cause you have a background that could potentially have gotten you accepted in advance, but I don't know that you leveraged that. Did you have a contract on the book before you started writing?
No, that was I've written everything on spec except for
Okay.
this last except for this four book series. I sold this is for being published by Severn River Publishing,
Okay.
and they gave me the four book series. It's the Nathan Burke series, so it's international espionage.
Yeah.
So these this is the first time I've had to work under the deadline and the pressure, right, of having a book due every 6 months, because even after I turn one in, I still have to get the copy edits back for the next book, you know, and working on all the other things that are going on. So it's less than 6 months a book from, you know, conception to turning it in. So it's a little different. It can the pressure can definitely, you know, maybe eat away a little bit at my creativity, you know, if I see I'm behind schedule and that deadline's looming. It's definitely different when you're writing on spec, you're writing for yourself, you're writing on your own timeline.
Yeah, that's a big concern. I mean, that's the kind of thing it kind of hits me in the kneecaps too, is, you know, I'm so used to just having an open timeline, just do whatever I want, you know. I can't imagine like four books trying to get those done on various timelines. I mean, how did you end up managing it?
You know, I've always been pretty self-motivated. So like I think this is the I'm working on I think book 13 right now. I've got three out with another publisher. I have these four, and then I have a couple others that I'd pulled publishing contracts based on the advice of my last agent. And so I have a whole bunch that are ready to go, and mostly psychological suspense, which I also enjoy writing. You know, so I'm looking to get those out there. But you know, it's about a process and habit, you know, and developing that writing practice. So it's getting, you know, I write to a word count every day. I aim for a word count every day. Let me say that. It's definitely don't hit it.
What's your word count? What are you aiming for?
Well, so right now I'm working multiple jobs. My wife and I own a restaurant, and so I'm the general manager and the manager of that. And I have we've turned it into a literary salon, Elaine's Literary
Oh,
Salon. So
that's
I'm
cool.
running that. So I've interviewed over 100 authors since we've opened, and we partner with Mystery Writers of America and Sisters in Crime and all these different groups or events. You know, so that takes a tremendous amount of time. So really my writing gets done very early in the morning. So it used to be 2,000 words a day. With all the other responsibilities I have, I shoot for 1,000. I've been gaming different processes to try to I'm always, you know, life changes, right? So I'm always trying to find new like hacks
Okay,
to
well, let's talk about
get more
those then.
productive.
I got to know about the hacks. What kind of hacks are we talking
See, you're exactly like me. Like I'm the same way. I talk to
about?
authors all the time, you know, because we have every given night we have authors in our literary salon, and we have people here, and I'm always asking the same things, like what's working for you, you know? So one of the ones that I'm working on now is I'm writing this book. It's a thriller. I'm shooting for, you know, 90,000 words roughly, and so I've decided to dictate the entire book, and I've used dictation in the past, you know, as like an add-on, and when I'm, you know, walking back and forth to work, and when I'm in the car, that kind of thing. But I said, you know what? It's so I seem to write so many more words. Like I could sit there for an hour and maybe write 600 or 700 words in front of the computer, but I can dictate that in like 15 minutes, you know, because it's just faster. Maybe that has more to do with my poor typing skills, you know, than anything else. So I'm as an experiment, I'm trying this. So I've tried all kinds of different like dictation software. I started with Dragon. I tried dictating directly into Scrivener, which is the word processing that I use. I dictated directly into Word at my computer. I've tried all these different things, notes on my iPhone. And what I found works best is the Word app on my phone, on my iPhone, and being in motion, because you get like that 10-point IQ bump, right, when you're walking around. So I'll sit at my computer and I'll struggle and I'll sweat and I'll suffer trying to get the words on the page. Then I'll get up and I'll walk outside for like 15, 20 minutes and I'll hit my word count quickly. So that actually worked really well for me.
I really envy that as a process. I've tried, you know, I think I'm the exact opposite of you, man. Because if I tried dictating something, I'd maybe get 600 words, and possibly only for the week. Because I just can't seem to dictate. I don't, you know, what's the secret? How do you? I don't know. It's just
So
too tough for me. I don't know why.
listen, everybody's different, right? I mean, I have friends who write with pen and paper, you know, whatever works for you, however you can connect to the story. So I always tell people don't try to change, but try things, you know, you never know. I can say that dictation, what I found was I used to, you know, when I was doing these 2,000 words a day, I'd sit at my computer and then I'd get up because you can only sit for so long and I'd go for a walk. And while I was walking, I'd have all these ideas and I'd let my mind wander. My subconscious would solve riddles, you know, it would just work for me. So I'd leave myself voicemails and I'd try to take notes on my phone when I was walking. And I'm like, why am I doing this? I should just write what I'm thinking, you know? And so that led to like gradually like building up this ability to dictate. And I started, and this is a good tip. The easiest way to do it is like have a scene in mind so you basically know what happens. And then do mostly the dialogue, right? Because when you're saying the words out loud, it's actually better dialogue. I find myself falling into the voices of the characters, which, you know, get some strange looks from people walking by me, but I'm in the city, so they're probably used to that, you know. But I, you know, I built up like that until I could finally start doing, you know, the action and the description. And I'm at a point now where it's indistinguishable. So if I look at something I've written, I don't know whether I dictated it or wrote it at the computer.
Is there a lot of editing involved when you dictate?
It depends on the software you're using. If it's bad software, it's so frustrating, you know. And one of the things I found was if you're looking at it on the computer and seeing the dictation, if you're seeing the errors, it's so hard to not fix them, right? So in the beauty of dictating is you can just like in like I wouldn't recommend walking into the street, but finding like a park, or I'll walk back in front of our restaurant, you know. So like I don't really have to worry about bumping into people. I'm just sort of walking in a straight line, and I let my mind wander, you know. I let it go, and I just say the words as they come out. And you know, imagine when I was a kid, I used to like, you know, hide under the covers with the light and scribble away way past my bedtime writing stories. And I'd write so fast that I get blisters from the pencil on my finger. And I know a lot of writers who feel that, like you're channeling story, right? You know, and so it's the same thing, only it's much easier when you're dictating. So, you know, it's worth the effort to just see if you can do it. But I would say it probably took me 3 weeks before it actually started working properly. So don't get too soon.
I think you've hit on something though. It sounds like you had like a warm-up approach, you know, doing it, you know, you're just dictating the notes. Maybe that's what I'm doing wrong. I need to try just, you know, dictating some notes or something first, not just a full story.
Do a scene and just do like between two characters and do the dialogue, you know. It'll come out natural, and actually the dialogue's a lot better when it's spoken.
So what other tips and tricks? Let's dive in. You said you try stuff all
Yeah,
the
you know, I've tried a host of, you know, different like word processing programs and
time.
different, you know, working on iPads and laptops and desktops. And you know, I found being in motion certainly helps. Scrivener is wonderful, and I teach people how to use Scrivener all the time. It's basically it's Word on steroids. You know, I think something like 80 or 90% of writers use it right now. And it's, you know, it's listen, whatever works for you. If you have, you know, but I don't know how anyone writes a book in like Word, because it's just so hard to
Same.
find things. It's so inefficient, you know. And on Scrivener, it's like Word on steroids. And so it operates just like Word, except you have all these bells and whistles, and you have all the, and for me, the big thing is the format, like the structural advantage of it. You get a binder on the left when you're looking at your screen, and I break all my stories into four acts, you know, act one, act 2A, 2B, act three. And so I have like the scenes and folders, and it's just like little Word documents, you know, so they're right there. So I can look at the outline, I can move stuff around, I've got character sketches and setting sketches, you know, and so it's all in one place. So I'm not like hunting in, you know, for you know, little post-it pads, or you know, I'm not digging through documents figuring out where I put something. So it's really about efficiency. You know, the more time I can spend like writing the words, getting them actually on the page, is that's efficient. Anything else is kind of a waste of time for me.
Do you are you a plotter or are you a pantser?
I'm a huge plotter, right? So I've always outlined, but what I found is, so it's kind of a false dichotomy, right? Like I go to these you know, conferences, as I'm sure you do, and everyone's like, are you a plotter or pantser? But almost everybody is somewhere in between, you know. So I've talked to people who are like, oh, I could never outline, because they hear that word outline and it just, it's like toxin. But they know how their story ends, you know, or they know where they're going with it. And that's sort of an
So
outline, you
you
know what I
did an
mean?
outline, you just outlined only one part.
Yeah, no, exactly. And what I found is the more I write, and like I said, I think I'm on book 13 right now, the more I write, the more I realize I've internalized a lot of structure and things. So I outline less than I used to, but I definitely do like the, you know, the big like 10 or 15 beats in a story, and I have it broken into acts, and I know the turning point, you know, the midpoint and the darkest night and like these kind of key scenes. But I let myself go. So like what all the pantsers will tell you. And by the way, I've had authors who are upset by the term pantser. You know, they're like, oh, it's so demeaning. You know, it's like, so a good one I heard was architect and gardener. You know, so
I've
I
heard
don't know
that
if that actually
before.
works.
No, I have
It's the
heard that
same video.
before. Discovery writer, that's the one I hear most people
Oh
talk.
yeah, discovery writer is good, but I allow that, right? So like if your character's doing something, and I made a mistake on one of my first books where I had an outline, like a deep outline, and my character was trying to do something else, and I just forced them into what I wanted them, what I'd planned, you know, and that's really a mistake. So now I go with it. Like I'm writing a big kind of climactic scene towards the end of act two, And it was supposed to be five short. I write short scenes, like, 1,000, 1,200 word scenes. And it was supposed to be five. Then it moved to 12. I'm at like 18 scenes right now. And I realized this is really what the book is, So I'm going to end up cutting more at the beginning. So this will be most of act two when I'm writing.
That's
but I think, yeah, you got to let your characters grow, right? Because you get to know them as you write.
Yeah.
And, and things come to you, right? And you don't want to be in the middle of a story and be like, wow, that would be great, and then not do it because you outlined it in your head, a month before. That's silly.
Right. Yeah. But the problem is you've got four books in this series, and I assume the rest are series of some kind, right?
No, the rest are all standalones.
Okay.
They're all kind of high concept. Each one's a different thing. And within this four book series, each one is a high concept in a way. Each one's about something different, right?
So how does that impact because if you've plotted something for all four books, we'll say, and you're on book two now, and you didn't, do you go back to the previous books? So you're on book four, but the first book's about to be published. So do you go back to, add something because you want to pay something off in book four? I mean, how do you manage it?
Kevin, I would love it if I could. And I'm envious of people who are self-published because you have that creative control.
Right.
Like, that would be wonderful to be able to go back and change something because you need it later.
Right.
But unfortunately, I'm traditionally published. So no, it's the book's formatted, the cover's done, it's in the process, right? It's coming out in about a month. So no. There are a couple times I wish I could have gone back and done that. But I also didn't plan out all four books that much. Like, it's all about internal character, right? And like, how does this character change? And this is my first series. So every other book, I had these radical, changes and, flaws that were fixed or, in the ways the internal mixed with the external. So the plot, and the internal change work together to come, and to come together in act three. And for this one, it's a series. I mean, I know you write series. It's much harder because you can't have that dramatic change in every book. That would be ridiculous,
right?
So I have to have change. So the stuff that I came up with for book one, and I'd left it open for a series. And when my publisher wanted it, they said, well, can this be a series? So I was like, absolutely. You always say yes to that.
When your check clears, it absolutely can.
Absolutely. And I get it too, right? I mean, you as an indie publisher too, you know this. When you bring in readers, I think you maintain what, about 40% from one book to the other of the initial readers. So you start to build a base quicker. So by book two or three or four, or whatever, you start to pay off.
Yeah.
And so I get that it's easier to market. I can say as a writer, it's more fun to just sort of write whatever you want next, as opposed to writing within a series. And I wonder sometimes, I mean, I've heard you guys talk about it on Writer's Inc, like at what point, do you write to market, or what point do you write what your publisher needs versus that thing that you want, even if it's off brand?
Yeah.
I can tell you as a writer, I've made every mistake possible. And a big one for me has been like every, except for this series, which is all one subgenre, right? They're all thrillers, suspense, thriller, mystery, but they're all different subgenres.
Yeah.
So like from my first book did pretty well. I think it's still the bestseller for Black Rose Writing. That was the first publisher that I had. I think it's still their best-selling thriller. That did pretty well. And then book two, though, that was psychological suspense. And book two, Unseen, was a straight up crime, like conspiracy terrorism thriller. Hmm. So the audiences were different. There was very little carryover between the two audiences.
Yeah.
And I could tell through like Facebook ads, you can see the age and the gender, and like it breaks down the demographics. And I believe the first one was like 80% female, and the second book was like 90% male.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't the same people. And that's a really bad way to try to build a following.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, and your standalones, and because you range within that genre, I mean, were you thinking at all about how do I carry people over to this? Because it's a big leap for them to go from like, I trust him on these, standalone books, but do I trust him enough to read four whole books with, a unifying story? Is that going to be a leap I'm willing to take? What, did you put some thought into that ahead of time?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
that's a great question, and like, how do you bring people in? Like, this is my first series. So series are just different. Like, even marketing the series, like you're talking about, how do you acquire authors initially for book one? Right.
Right. Right.
But even marketing it, like my publisher initially was going to launch a book every 6 months, which is, I'm turning them in every 6 months. And then recently they want to do a more rapid release and do a release every 3 months. So I have one coming out in September and then December and then March, so like they're coming out fast. past.
Yeah.
And so in marketing that, I have to be careful how I'm doing it and how I'm talking about the books, because I don't want to overwhelm people with this. So I kind of have to market as a series as mm-hmm. opposed to each individual book, I yeah. think.
Yeah.
I mean, you could tell me you're better at this than I am.
You know, I mean, it really just depends. I mean, my series is an ongoing series. So, you know, ideally I want people to jump on at the earliest possible point, because I want them to read all like 14 other books in that series. Right. So yeah, that brings me around, because I wanted to ask you, like, why four books? Because you've mentioned a few times, like you write in like three acts. So it would seem like you would want to write three books to tell the overall story, but now you've got this little fourth act happening. So what made you decide on that?
Well, the publisher. So the publisher asked, yeah, they right. said it would be a three or four book series, and they settled on four books. Yeah. I mean, I can see the wisdom in doing like a trilogy, you know, yeah. and having that big overall kind of three act structure in a three book series.
Yeah.
Honestly, though, I mean, if it goes well, I'll keep the series going. Right.
Okay.
So like, ideally,
that was going to be my next question. It was like, you know, are you leaving it open? If this thing hits and your readers love it, you know, are you willing to write more books in this universe?
Absolutely. You know, any way that I can grow readership. And what I'll do is I'll just continue to write some of the other things I like to write, like psychological suspense. I'll do that on the side. And just, I don't know, it's hard with branding, right? Like if I do that, if I'm writing psychological suspense and international espionage, yeah. I have to make it very clear, either writing under a pseudonym for psychological suspense, which I really don't want to do, yeah. or just making it super clear, you know, either with a different publisher or with a different jacket copy mm. or the way I market it, to let people know these are separate.
Just you set know, like, the psychological suspense books in Europe, and then they'll just consider them
international. That's right. I'll make it all happen to former spies.
That's what you do. That's the
That's not a bad idea.
So you mentioned your salon earlier, and I saw a little bit about it. I wanted to talk about that because, you know, clearly it puts you talking to authors. So talk to me a little bit about what the salon is. And you're using salon in the sort of traditional sense, like, you know, a group of peers meeting to discuss topics, right? That's not
yes,
people
I'm
doing
not,
each
I'm
other's
not doing
hair.
Anybody's hair. Yeah. And as a bald guy, you probably wouldn't want me doing your hair either. I wouldn't know how to do my own anymore. Yeah, so it's the restaurant's my wife's thing, you know, and she's a foodie. She's been a fellow at think tanks. She's a brilliant. She's an author herself. She writes nonfiction. She's one of the world's leading experts on the Muslim Brotherhood. So she does a lot of counterterrorism work. And wow, but this wow. is her baby. And when I saw the space, I mean, I really didn't want to be I kind of got, you know, because it's our family thing, that's how I came into it. Yeah. But I saw the space and I'm like, well, why don't we just give this, give authors a place for free where they can celebrate their work?
Yeah.
You know, because we know what it's like. You know, you can go to a bookstore and three people can show up for a signing, you know, but when we come, we have this gorgeous, it's really elegant. We have books and we have, you know, I've had, you know, 60, 70 people here for book signings, and, you know, we partner with all these different writing groups and we have book yeah. clubs that come. So literally on any night, I'll have an author come up to me and I counsel them in the way that I can tell them all the mistakes I've made and what not to do, so they don't make the same mistakes. You right. know? So right. at least a couple authors come in and I'll have coffee with them, you know, during the week. But what we do is we offer this free space for authors, and we say, you know, I usually do a 45-minute one-on-one interview like this, right? Yeah. This is fun.
Yeah,
and we talk about whatever. I don't, yeah. you know, script. I don't plan the questions. We talk about business. We talk about craft. We talk about process. Whatever. And so it's really interesting, because I've had a lot of like New York Times bestsellers that I've interviewed in here. I've also had some local self-published people who've sold 100 copies. You know, I've done yeah. poets and children's book authors and mystery thriller suspense, like a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So I get a real feel for like how people work and what works and what doesn't. And I've actually, I mean, there's a bunch of things that like successful authors do consistently, you know, yeah. and understanding everyone's process is different. And there's a thing that people who are struggling just don't do.
Right.
Like I can't tell you how many authors I have who come in here and say, I'm going to write when, you know, and it's like, there has to be all these perfect circumstances and this has to happen. And I'm like, writers write, right? At the basic level, you just have to develop that practice and write every day. And it takes, you know, I've heard it takes a million words, you know, that Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours thing. I don't know if that's true or not, but the more you write, if it's focused practice, the better you get. You know, and so developing that habit's really, really important. But it's interesting to hear how just people write in very different ways. And like when I write, I feel like I'm channeling. I feel like the story exists out there in the universe somehow, and it's coming through me when I'm really in it, when I'm in the zone.
That's
You
kind of
know?
The Michelangelo approach. The
Oh,
statue's already in the marble kind of thing. Yeah.
exactly. I'll take it. Any Michelangelo reference you want to? Yeah, absolutely.
That one's free. The next one's going to cost you. So.
Oh, I'm in. Let me get my checkbook. So it's fun. So we come and we do those 45-minute interviews. I've also done a bunch of panels. I've done like a horror panel and a crime panel, and I just recently did a mystery and romance panel. We have events in here. We had a big Great Gatsby party with Mystery Writers of America. You
Oh,
know,
nice.
I'm now, by the way, I'm a DC area ambassador for Authors Guild. So I'm going to
Okay.
start hosting some Authors Guild events here as well. But it's all for free. And the thing is, like, we get something as a restaurant out of it. Like, if somebody has a drink or they buy food, you know, we get something from that.
Yeah.
But really, it's just a way we have the space, and it's a cool place to, you know, you've done all this hard work and you've worked in isolation, and then you're able to come to the place and bring family and friends and colleagues and readers and just do something to relax and celebrate it. So it's fun. Like we just had a noir at the bar. I think that's the sixth one I've done. That's like the, you know, 8-minute short crime stories. They're like
Right.
dark stories. And we're hosting a short con conference for short crime writers. We did it last year. Was our inaugural we hosted, and this will be year two.
So
And
like
we're going to
under
do
five
large.
foot.
Yes,
I'm
yes, yeah. No, yeah. We
sorry.
put a bar at the front door, and if you can't get under it, it's like a limbo literary salon.
Yeah. So
Yeah, so
you
it's fun.
mentioned DC. So this is you're in DC. I didn't even ask you that earlier.
Yeah,
Is
no,
this
so we're
bar
in
in DC?
Old Town Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay.
So we're a block from the Potomac. So I walk to the
Yeah,
end of the
yeah.
street, I can literally see the US Capitol. So
Very cool.
we're like 5 miles from downtown DC. It's right in the middle of the historic districts. It's a beautiful area, but it's just kind of a cool way. Like, I mean, I've had authors when they come in, they're like, "Hey, I heard about this." I mean, I don't do outreach, they come to me, you know,
Right,
and
right.
people will come in, and sometimes it's 3 a week, and
Yeah.
but they'll come in, and I've had several of them just start crying when I told them there's no charge to you, you know, like they're like, okay, I'll buy this. I mean, don't buy anything, don't spend a dime. If people want to buy something, let them do it, you know.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
and the interviews are great. Like, we've started posting a few of the podcasts. You've got all the good tech gear, I can see it. It's
Yeah.
terrific. We've been a little challenged with some of our audio, but we're getting there. And some of the interviews have been really terrific.
Yeah. What's some of the more surprising things that have come out of the interviews that you've learned now?
I think just generally, like, how different everybody is. People are just different. They write at
Yeah.
different times of day. They use different, you know, devices to write. Story comes to them, and you know, the people, like, for me, I have to like give myself a word count. I sit down. I need a concentrated time to like lose myself and, you know, really get into that
Right,
world. And
right.
other people are writing, you know, 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there. And I've done that, by the way, because I'm doing basically three jobs in addition to the writing. I've done that where I wrote the last book, book two, I think, in the series. I wrote it about 10 minutes at a time, and it was just brutal.
Yeah. No, I've been there. I've had that. And it's not like I don't have the time to write. It's like that's all the energy I can expend right now. So that's
How many
happened.
books have you written?
I'm around 70 right now.
Wow. I mean,
70
that's
titles.
amazing. That is such a congratulations. That's
Well,
such an
thank you.
accomplishment.
Yeah. And I
And
feel like every book is starting over. Every book is book one. So, let's speaking of books though, and book ones, let's talk a little bit about the Havana Syndrome, which is what brings you here today. What's the premise of the book?
So I was back in, I think it was 2021-ish, the CIA report came out. And it talked about Havana syndrome, and it was talking about how these are they call them anomalous health incidents, you
Yeah.
know. And like, if you could be more vague, I'd like to hear
Right.
how. And they talk about they were blaming psychogenic causes, so basically
Oh.
saying mass hysteria was causing this. But if you look at, and I didn't know much about it either, but you know, I'd read the things. So
Yeah.
if you look at it, I mean, that's obviously not true. Like, so
Yeah.
some people may be glomming on because they want, you know, they want to get disability, or they, I mean, I'm sure that happens, right? But for the majority, and there's been over 300 like US personnel and embassies around the world that have, you know, been stricken by this, what they call, the first one happened in the embassy in Havana, right? So I think there's 15 US embassies at this point that have been hit, and some of our allies' embassies have been hit as well. And so, but it was just so obviously false that these were this all psychogenic, and then you know these CIA case officers or FBI agents all get stricken at the same time in a meeting, you know, and somehow they're the it's like give me a break, you know. And I know there's stresses, so I was like, you know, doing the writer thing. What if I do that all the time with news stories? So I'm like, why is the CIA lying about this, right? And then that sort of led me to this. And. And I that's why I came out with this pretty quickly too, because things change all the time. So, you know, what I found is when I tend to write books and then they come true. Like that's been happening to me quite a bit. So I wanted to get this one out fast.
It's kind of hard to keep up now though, because like I can't invent things fast enough to keep up with reality at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think our current climate's going to put like the Babylon Bee out of business, right? You can't come up with things more absurd than are actually happening in reality.
Right.
But I mean, so honestly, that's a danger too. Like I'm writing psychological suspense. So the first one's about Havana syndrome, and it's Nathan Burke, who's my FBI agent. He's working counterterrorism. So I spent my whole career, or most of my career, doing counterterrorism around the world.
Yeah.
And so he's doing counterterrorism, and then he takes his daughter. His wife leaves him for another man. And she's in the Caribbean at an embassy. And so he takes his daughter down there to spend time with her. And when he arrives there, his wife is hit with the Savannah syndrome. So he's trying to figure out what's going on. He's getting a lot of pushback from the government. So he basically has to create his own rogue investigation because he wants to protect his wife. He wants to win her back, you know, which is sort of a theme throughout this whole series, is that he's trying to protect his family and balance work and family. And so it deals a little bit with relationships and things like that.
Okay. All right. You got me hooked. It's a, I don't know. It was reminiscent of several books now that I've read recently. So I think this is a kind of theme right now. You're tapping into a zeitgeist.
Well, good. I mean, that's crazy, right? Because you never know. Like I wrote this book like 3 years ago, right? So you just never know when it comes out or what's going to happen. Like I remember after I signed the contract, which was about a year ago, there was some big information that came out about Havana syndrome. Some news broke, you know.
I remember seeing a lot about it. Yeah.
Yeah. How was that? I mean, 60 Minutes have done a couple shows on it since then. So you just never know. And I think, you know, there's what, 3 million plus ISBNs a year that come out. So there's probably, you know, those are for different formats, but with all the self-published books that are on like Amazon, ASINs, there's probably 3 million books a year that come out. Mm-hmm. And so it's so hard to break out of it. And a big part is the zeitgeist that you're talking about, you know, like what's going to resonate with people at a given time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And my next book is the Khorasan Retribution. And that's about a Afghan Foreign Service national who's working with the U.S. who gets left behind when we withdraw. And so it deals a lot with the opioid crisis and with that. And book three is the China Gambit, which deals a lot with like Chinese infiltration in the country. I mean, they're like disintegration warfare. I mean, it's interesting stuff, but this stuff's changing all the time, you know? So I'm just sort of crossing my fingers and hoping nothing major happens before the books come out.
I know, man. At this point, I'm starting to kind of avoid certain topics because I literally can't keep up. Like the current book is about AI, and I can't keep up with like things I invented when I first started are now just old news. You know, it's like it was fiction when I first started. I've got an entire series built around this idea of an AI, an advanced AI that is now kind of tame compared to what's actually happening out there.
Yeah, so, I mean that is a problem if you're writing near future things or even sci-fi at this point, because we're accelerating with our you know, scientific community is growing so quickly. My third book was The Forever Game, and that was about life extended technology. I had a friend who was in Silicon Valley at an AI company, and he was telling me about a friends and family beta program where they were downloading consciousness. And I'm like, I mean, we can't even define consciousness, right? So it's like, what does that even mean? But I heard about it. I'm like, oh, this has to be a book, you know? So I wrote about it, but I got that out fast just because, you know, it changes like just what you're saying. You know, if I held on to that book for a couple more years, I wouldn't be able to publish
completely
it.
Lose relevance. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this one, Havana Syndrome, hopefully is going to remain relevant for a good long while, coming out June 17th. So that's not far from now. I don't know when this is airing, but it's not far from today when we're chatting. And then when does the second one come out? You said you're sorry.
The second one comes out in September. That's the Khorasan Retribution.
Okay.
And then the China Gambit comes out, I believe, in December. And then the one I'm working on now, it's the tentative title. I'm the only one who knows it, so let's see if the publisher likes it. But it's the Uganda Protocol, and that would come out in March of 2026.
Okay. Yeah, it is rapid release. Yeah. It's a couple of months between books. Yeah, good. Hopefully that works out for you. Cascades into sales for the other books. That's the way I look at all this now. It's like everything is meant to actually be marketing for the other books.
I hope so. I mean, I think that's a, I really do think that's a valid strategy though.
Yeah.
You know, like when I get emails from readers all the time, as I'm sure you do. And, you know, they're always asking me, what should I read next? Or what else? You know, what do you recommend?
What's the preferred reading order for these five series that you have?
You're like, start, but isn't it sort of like a double-edged sword? Because you, with every book, you become a better writer. Now you've wrote 70 books. So, you know, but if you went back to the first five, right, you're probably a much better writer at this point.
Yeah.
So like to direct people, like my first book is still my bestseller, which I don't know if that's a good sign or not, but it's still, you know, it's still the best selling book.
Yeah.
But if I direct people back that, I mean, that I wrote that so I wrote that like 8 years ago, you know, so I'm a much, much better writer at this point.
Here's what I think. And I think that it's good if someone, if your bestseller is your first book, I think that's good. It gets the attention that you want. And then it only gets better from there. So the readers who stick with you throughout get to see you grow as a writer and they become lifelong fans.
You know, so, you are so full of optimism. I absolutely love that because it's a brutal business.
If I wasn't, I'd have to crawl under this desk and just cry throughout the whole evening. So,
you know what? Let me tell you this, though. A couple years ago, I don't want to get dark with this, but my brother-in-law was supposed to be the manager of our restaurant and he passed away unexpectedly. Oh. So I had to step in and my wife was devastated and her family. So I was working 18 hours a day at this restaurant, trying to get it up and open, right? Get the doors open. And so for about 4-ish months, I didn't write a word. And that'd been, you know, for years I've been writing every day, 2,000 words a day. So like I was just, it was all I could do to get this restaurant going. And I listened to Writers Inc. podcast every single day because I hadn't listened to it before that.
Yeah.
And so I went back to episode one. I'm one of these completionists, you know, and I went back to episode one. And every day I'd walk in about 20 minutes to get in and I'd listen to it. And I'd listen to it on the way home. And that was the only like connection to the literary world that I had for like 4 or 5 months. And honestly, it kept me sane. Like, I mean, you know how isolating writing is and you're in your own head and these stories and stuff, but being away from it and being forced to work like basically every waking moment doing something else.
Right.
It just kept my head in it a little bit. And it was like that respite, that 20 minutes of walking back and forth to the restaurant really was like the one moment when I was relaxed and I felt like I was still connected to my writer self. So I want to thank you guys for that. Like, I mean, it's a really big deal. You know, you guys, you talk to writers, you don't see all the people that you're not directly talking to, right? That this show is going out to. And writers are often alone and they hear these stories and like everything that you and I have suffered through with writing.
Right.
Everyone else has suffered through too. You know?
Yeah.
It just really means something when you can hear that other people, like I see people's faces light up when I talk to them because they're like, oh my God, I'm not alone. You know, like, yes, we've all done that. Here's how you stop it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, no. Well, I appreciate that. And the whole team appreciates that, man. They all of us work pretty hard on it. So thank you for noticing. All right. Where can people find you online so they can pay tribute to you?
Oh, pay tribute. I like that. the best place is my website. It's jeffreyjameshiggins.com, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, jeffreyjameshiggins.com. I'm on Facebook and X and, you know, a few of the other things, but honestly, other than pushing out our schedules and that type of thing, I'm not on social media that much. I just don't have time, but the website, I will return emails. It's jeffrey@jeffreyjameshiggins.com is my email. Feel free to reach out to me directly.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you. It's been really terrific. So it's an honor to talk to you.
So JD read off a litany of things this guy's done, before the interview. He juggles a lot of jobs, but he writes to a very tight deadline. So, having discussed bean knitting, earlier, like how do you guys stay productive when you feel like life is just pulling you in all directions? What keeps you, you know, both like with quality output and high output? How do you balance it?
I'm pretty good about just sticking to a schedule, you know, so I do everything at a certain time of the day and I only allow so much time for each particular task. That's the only way I can do it. Because otherwise I spend too much time on one thing, not enough time on another, and then I start falling behind or whatever. But for me, that works.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever find that the less time you have, miraculously, the more you get done, like somehow you are
Oh,
now
yeah.
able, like it's the most irritating law in the universe, but it is like when I feel like I'm drowning, I'm getting the most done and like on the most on top of things. It's
Yeah.
unfair.
Yeah. No, it is true. Although my sleep suffers, so I don't know if
Well,
that's great. But yeah, I was shocked to hear that he's releasing every 3 months. I was kind
yeah.
of like,
That's wild.
whoa. But I wonder, because that was kind of, the self-publishing strategy, not the
Yeah.
big trad pub strategy. And he's with a smaller press. So I'm wondering if that is something that's happening with smaller presses now, this 3 month model. That would burn me out, to be honest. I don't think I
Yeah,
could do that.
that would be really hard. I don't know if I could do that. I mean, I suppose there's a world where that's possible if you ramp into that. So what I mean
Yeah.
is like, you spend time sort of like building up a certain amount of titles so that the publishing isn't necessarily dependent on the writing,
Yeah.
if that makes sense. Like, so you have titles that you can like edit, but then you're so far ahead, those are almost like your backlist titles that are coming out.
Right. So you've got like 20 novels in a shoebox.
Yeah.
Yeah, that like you're just waiting on edits
Yeah.
for, and then it's like you go to that and do like an intense edit thing and then like continue drafting and so that you can kind of pace that out.
So that's kind of the model I'm engaging with now, because I did the, for a while there, I was putting out a book a month, steadily. And
That's
that
insane.
is entirely the self-publishing rapid release model. And that's how I got burnt out too, right?
Yeah.
So, well, that and some other things. But now my output's a little stunted in comparison, but I've also got multiple projects going, and it just hasn't caught up yet to where. Because there will come a time where a book is coming out like every 3 months or something, but I'm spending like a year to 2 years ahead of time writing those books, and then they're going to be in various forms of production until release. So it's going to look like a whole bunch of stuff, like I'm just releasing a bunch of stuff all at once, but it's really just steady output over years.
Yeah.
Yeah. That still
Yeah, I'm
seems
kind of doing the same thing because I've got the three prequels to 4MK that I've been sitting on for a while now, and like I'm probably gonna release all three books on the same day. Like that's my general thinking.
wow, really?
Yeah, because
That's
nobody's done it before,
yeah.
so I
Yeah.
figured I'm always
Yeah.
trying to look for something weird, but like those books are done, so it's not like I'm writing three books in a day or whatever, that they're done and they're sitting there. I mean, because it takes me about 3 to 4 months or so to write a book, but I'm putting one out about every 6 months. So once he's, and I've been at this for 10 and a half, almost 11 years now. So when you start doing the math, you end up with a backlog of books. It sounds like this guy's just writing fast enough though to put it out.
Yeah.
Which is cool too. I mean, like you mentioned you used to do it, Kevin. I know a couple of people that, they kick out a book a month or a book every 2 months.
Yeah.
It's all about the pacing. If you can keep up that pace.
I
But a
actually
lot
think
of
I
people
could get
they
back to that, but I'm ramping up slowly.
Do you do it? Do you type them all, Kevin? Because I know he's saying he was dictating. Like, well, maybe that speeds you up. Do you type your books that you do out one a month, or
Yeah,
do
I
you
type
do
everything. I've tried
type?
dictation,
Yeah.
and it just isn't for me.
Oh yeah, you said
But
that in the interview. I was
yeah.
listening.
Yeah.
I haven't been
Yeah.
able to make it work for me either, but doesn't mean I wouldn't try it again, you know?
I think
Yeah.
we all listen to Kevin J. Anderson at some point, and then we pick up our phone and try to dictate a book, and it only seems
Right.
to work for Kevin J. Anderson.
Right. Right. So he said that he's a big plotter, but his outlines have gotten less detailed as he's sort of
That is
internalizes the
so interesting.
structure. Yeah. So how do you balance between plotting and discovery writing in what you do, in any of you?
I find that the more I outline, the more detailed my outlines tend to get. Like, and I guess that's where kind of the discovery for me comes in. I mean, obviously, like, there's still things that will happen as you're expanding the outline, but like, if you're writing a pretty comprehensive and detailed outline, I think the discovery happens a lot during that point for me.
Yeah. And I'm just like, even though I do detailed outlines, I'm not afraid to throw it away if it's
Right.
not
Well, yeah,
working while
there's
I'm
that
writing,
too.
right?
Yeah, I mean, good. I mean, I used to be a pantser on everything, and then Patterson brought me around to the outlining camp, and now we're kind of doing something that falls in between for the latest book. And I think for me, I have to have an ending in my head when I write that first page, and it just I think it keeps my subconscious going in the right direction. Like I know where I'm heading, and it doesn't mean that that ending is going to be the ending, but it's a ending, you know. So I've got an ending point for the book, one way or the other, because I don't. If you don't have that, I think you end up meandering, you go off into the weeds. You end up with a lot of stuff that has to get cut later. And sometimes that's necessary too. I mean, with the book that I'm working on right now, like we outlined the first, probably 90% of it. And then we had one particular scene that we know we want to be part of the climax for the book, but we left, that ending kind of ambiguous. And we've rewritten the last couple of chapters 4 or 5 times. We wrote some, we threw some away, we wrote other ones, until we get the right pieces to fit. There's so many different ways to do this. There's no right or wrong way.
Yeah, I've been playing with it because JD, the book you and I did a m this massive, really too big outline, but it was the only way I could do it, the only way I understood it, And then the next book, I did an outline, ended up scrapping the whole thing, starting over, doing another outline. I think I did that like 3 times before I finally just sort of wrote kind of a short treatment and knew all of what I wanted it to be, and then started and finished, and it was great. So the current book that I'm working on, I'm sort of back to pantsing, but I have this like loose sketch of what the book is. So out of all those, I think the middle one is the one that works best. I think writing a kind of, for me, for everyone else listening, you're gonna have to find your own way. But for me, so far, if I were to write like a one-page treatment of the story, including the major plot points, that's enough for me because I like to improv. It's like jazz. I want to improvise between the notes, not stick to the sheet music. So.
That's so interesting. I actually really I do best when I have a pretty comprehensive laid out outline where I know the characters and I know what's going to happen and I know what's going to end and I know what I'm sitting down to write that day, and it moves a lot better. When I have a lot of wiggle room, I've even tried like loose outlines, and even those trip me up. I really need that outline. Just do.
Yeah. So we'll make this the last question, but he talks about kind of the challenge of writing a series and not being able to revise earlier books, which is something that I struggle with, and I'm always tempted. But if you're writing a series, how do you keep, continuity while still leaving some room for flexibility?
I've gotten to experience both of these. So when I wrote the 4MK trilogy, those books were coming out, through the publisher, one at a time. So I couldn't go back and change anything. I got lucky as far as my overall arc. I had a lot of it plotted out in my head, so I think it still worked. But with the three prequels, I literally wrote all three books on my, and I haven't shared any of them with anybody. So yeah, as I was working on book two, I was able to go back to book one and, tweak some things and, kind of make sure that they all gel really well together. And I really like the ability to do that. And if I write another series, I'll probably do that again. I'll probably write the whole series before I publish the first book.
I've heard authors talk about that before, where, especially as a debut, you write the first novel, right? And it's standalone with serious potential. And then you get out there and now it's published and now it's successful. And now you're in like book three and you're like, man, I really wish I had put X in book one.
It's
And
just
that ship has
constraints,
sailed.
right? At
That's
that
why
point,
you,
it's just constraints. You're stuck where you're
yeah.
stuck, and you can only go forward. And sometimes you have
Yeah.
to do some creative problem solving. You're like, man, I did this, so now I have to do this.
I think we talked about this last episode, but like that's one of the problems I'm having now because I've got a long running series, and there were things I didn't do early on that I wish I'd done, but I'm kind of at a point now where it's like, because I'm sort of locked in, I can't really change anything specifically in order to open up these new avenues that I might like to explore. So it would just be better for me to just start writing something entirely new instead of trying to continue the series. I'll continue the series. I don't want people who read this to yell at me, but I'll continue writing the series, but I'm sort of at a, it's going to start getting a little stale unless I can figure something out because, I've got 13 or 14 other books of continuity to deal with.
Or you just do the TV trick. Now it's an alternate timeline where
Well, I
something
was just
different
going to say,
happened.
it used to drive me
Retcon.
crazy when I was a teenager that comic books would do that all the time, right?
Yeah.
Like now all of a sudden it's like a whole new, and you're like, wait, now, and it's a
What?
new series. It would be so annoying. And now I'm like, oh,
That's why they did that.
I
Yeah.
get
What do you
it.
mean, Superman number one? I was on like 830.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
Oh, yeah.
right, cool. I guess with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Brian McCauley coming on. Brian's a screenwriter turned author who's worked on everything from sitcoms to horror. His debut novel, Curse of the Reaper, was named one of the best horror novels of 2022 for by Esquire magazine. His latest is called Breathe In, Bleed Out and releases September 2nd. Brian McCauley.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.